Well, we spoke with Iraj Abedian last week, and there were some wonderful insights that he provided on how Iran is, how it operates, or the regime in Iran, rather than saying talking about Iranians themselves. And then over the weekend, after just 10 days of action, a 24-year reign of a dictator ended. And in fact, the family has been running the country, Syria, since 1970. So it's 54 years, almost 55 years that they've been in power. And in 10 days, after a long struggle, suddenly they have been deposed. We'll find out from Iraj what it means and why. Iraj, thanks for joining us. Just to perhaps let those people who don't know you, you were born and raised in Iran. So you know the country terribly well, came to South Africa 45 years ago. So you are South African, an academic for 20 years, a entrepreneur for 20 years. In between, you were the spokesperson for Standard Bank in many ways as their chief economist. So you've got, I said in the beginning of our last interview, you're the ideal, you're the perfect person to interview on the Middle East, because that's where you come from. But now this development that we've seen, this dramatic development over the past 10 days. And last night we heard that Bashar al-Assad, the deposed ruler of Syria, is now sitting in Russia. And the Americans have had numerous airstrikes on ISIS bases around Syria. So I guess it's on the one hand, there will be people celebrating that the dictator is gone. But on the other hand, with the Americans now starting to send airstrikes, it does appear that maybe there's a new element of risk. You help us through all of this and just tell us where the alliances were, and perhaps starting with Bashar al-Assad.
Thanks very much, Alette, and good to talk to you again. I think the origin of Assad's dynasty, so to speak, goes back to his father, who was an army general belonging to a small minority from a societal, from a religious point of view in Syria. Syria is a very interesting land, has been historically the wellspring of philosophical, artistic, cultural development of the Islamic civilization, and made of a whole vast variety of belief systems, Jews, Muslims, Christians. That area has got a very prominent history in the Christian history. So Syria, and more broadly known as Sham in the Middle East, which is a region much wider than today's Syria, is highly respected by all religious groups and by all philosophical scientific orientations. In that context, the coup d'etat by General Assad in 1971 suddenly brought a different reality, a fairly dictatorial reality by a small minority against the majority, and small minority being itself a very small sect of the Shia Islam, as opposed to the majority who were Sunnis. So suddenly you have General Assad running the nation and the region with iron fists, with brutality never seen before in that part of the world. And that area had before belonged to the Ottoman Empire. I emphasize that because today's role that President Erdogan of Turkey plays is linked to that historic affiliation, sentiments, as well as claims that Turkey has on its rightful position with regard to the governance and the structures in Syria. So since 1971, it has been a hotbed of contestation from a religious point of view, from a territorial point of view. Then comes the fall of Iraq and the rise of ISIS. ISIS suddenly claims that it is not a Shia group, it's a radical Sunni group and wants to dominate that whole region. And that brings a very interesting, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Suddenly Iran and the United States and parts of Iraq and parts of Saudi Arabia and almost everybody coalesces to eliminate ISIS. In that configuration, Iran has got its own ambitions, and that it's going to steam for 45 years to eliminate Israel. And its proximity with the U.S. creates opportunities to create what Iranians call it the axis of resistance, and Americans, George W. Bush, called it the axis of evil. Be my guest, whatever side of the equation you want to take, you may do so. But that was the, really the genesis of disrupting the balance and the social peace and economic prosperity of the Middle East. It brought untold, immeasurable pain to a number of nations, beginning in Iran. And estimated, this is according to the government of Iran's estimates, something between $40 to $50 billion were used to set up these proxies in Lebanon in the form of Hezbollah, in Iraq, in Syria, putting enormous amount of resources to back Assad, who had no claim. In fact, Bashar Assad himself, unlike his father, was a medical doctor specializing in eye surgery and had really very little ideological or political ambitions, except that he loved to be the ruler, and he was a brutal ruler. And the backing that he received from the regime in Iran, according to the United Nations, not according to me or others, according to the report of the UN special rapporteur, what they did, which is the combination of Assad and the Iranian military wing of the regime, which is called Iran Revolutionary Guards, headed by a very, very prominent and extremely successful military guy called General Soleimani, who, by the way, in January 20 was killed by President Trump at that time. They did untold, immeasurable, and estimated 500,000 to 700,000 Syrians were literally mowed down in the name of fight against ISIS and for the sake of creating corridors of access for the Iranian regime and keeping Assad in power. 3 million, these are all estimates by different groups, 3 to 4 million internally were dislocated, and then another 3 to 4 million that are in Germany, in UK, everywhere. 1 million of them in Turkey. Therefore, Turkey today has every incentive to do what it can to stabilize that area. So that's the origin of this. And being in a society, as I mentioned earlier, in Syria, which on the one hand, a very proud nation, proud of the acceptance of different belief systems, a center of cultural, philosophical, scientific developments 1,000 years ago, in Christian as well as in Islamic dispensations, suddenly they found themselves fragmented, brutalized, and mutilated insofar as the geographic integrity of that nation is concerned.
So in 2011, when we had Arab Spring, and that saw Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and Yemen having dictators deposed, at that point, there was a challenge against Assad. And I guess that also changed everything. Up until that point, he'd been brutal, but he hadn't been crazy brutal. But then the Russians got involved, as well as Iran. Why would the Russians want to support this lunatic?
Russians have a military base there, both air and sea. And they have they want access to oil reserves and distributions and military presence in the Mediterranean. So that's the only presence that they have. And therefore, in new Russia's, if you like, ambition to revitalize its global superpower positions, Russians wanted a place, and Syria was a perfect place for them. I think that brings another interesting dynamics into this equation. You have at the moment three aspirant leaders who want to have dominance for different reasons. Turkey wants to revive its leadership of the Islamic world and Middle East power, regional power, because of the Ottoman Empire. They want to reestablish that. They have claims, and historically they're correct. Once upon a time, over 100 years ago, Syria was part of the Ottoman Empire. Russia, today under Putin, wants to regain its regional and military and geopolitical dominance of the USSR, and that's well known. And it's got a little bit of Christian historic sort of end day flavor into it. And then Iran, you have the mullahs who put their stamp of authority on the entire Islamic world, not just in Middle East, everywhere. So you have now three very, very interesting aspirations, all of them dictatorial, all of them prevail at all cost, and people and cost is just part of the journey. That's how they see it. That's how they talk about it. So you have, in the middle of that, the Arab Spring happens, and the Assad regime, being a minority, as I mentioned, in Syria, it was obviously vulnerable, and it had to survive, and Iran was ready to do it because it was perfect for Ayatollah's ambition of creating a ring of resistance around Israel in order to achieve the ultimate and final elimination of Israel from the Middle East. Iraq had been destabilized by Americans had deposed Saddam Hussein, but Iran could not get to Lebanon, could not get to Palestine. And Syria became a perfect bridge, pathway, or carting weapons, arranging troops, training, etc., etc. So they got involved.
So they got involved for that reason. Were there idealistic reasons as well? Was it again a case of my enemy's enemy is my friend, or were the mullahs happy to work with Assad because they saw that he would spread their version of Islam?
Correct. Remember, he was the only, he was represented a group in Syria called the Alawites, who are the only Shia group. And Khomeini and the mullah suddenly found him as the only ally in religious terms, because the rest of the region was either Sunnis or Druzis or Christian. And they had no reason to partner with the mullah. So, yes, of course, the religion played a key role, and therefore Assad agreed to be an ally of Iran. And Iran put, as I mentioned, an estimated $40 to $50 billion to prop up, also to set up military bases, training bases, pathways for manufacturing, as well as for the transportation and logistical use into Lebanon, which then enabled the mullahs to create what is now called Hezbollah. Hezbollah was a political movement, was a religious movement, but it made it into a force to be reckoned with, a force that today and up to now, at least, has been the main factor deciding how Lebanon should be run, who should be the president. And for years, as you know, they haven't had president because Hezbollah would disagree. Now, of course, that equation has changed, and it will change more. So I think Iran used the oil reserves, oil revenues that Iranians should have used to operate and develop their own country in order to establish, if you like, ideological or, if you believe, religious and strategic goal of, according to the mullahs, of encircling Israel with a ring of resistance at all cost. money doesn't matter and the impoverishment of the Iranian nation doesn't matter at all, to the extent that as we speak, according to the government statistics, 70% of the Iranians every day go to sleep undernourished. Government is bankrupt. They cannot pay salaries and infrastructure, water, land, resources, everything else is underinvestment beyond belief for a country that has spent $40-50 billion on setting up these rings of resistance that are now falling apart. So I think that is the ambition of one of these dictators in the form of Ayatollah.
So how come it was so quick, this deposing of Assad, after it had taken decades of other resistance, armed resistance indeed, which was not successful, and then this, within 2 weeks, it was all over?
Look, I'm not a military specialist, but from what I know of, based on principles, 3-4 things coincided in a very interesting way. Turkey, over the past 6-7 years, has been training what is now the group that has conquered and deposed Assad, has been training them quietly for its own geopolitical reason. It's got security concerns as well, because part of the segments of Syria is run by the Kurds, and the Kurds are, at least the military wing of the Kurds, is, as far as Turkey is concerned, is a terrorist group destabilizing Turkey, having claim to independence. The last thing that Turkey wants is that now Kurds in Syria also get recognition and become independent. The Iraqis have, and the next thing in Turkey, they also want independence, some kind of federal dependence. So that is a no-go area for Erdogan, who wants to revive the Ottoman Empire, never mind segmenting its own Turkey. So that has been going in the background. In the meantime, Russia got involved in Ukraine and couldn't maintain the troops and the focus on propping up or even keeping up in the intelligence. This is not because I say so. Yesterday, the foreign minister of Russia, Mr. Lavrov, said we were caught off guard. We didn't expect it. Iranians, as I mentioned, they have problem at home. They were supporting Hezbollah. And the last thing that they were keeping an eye was what's happening in Syria, because there was more existential threat in the form of Hezbollah's assimilation. And therefore, Turkey thought, well, that's my moment. And of course, I have absolutely no doubt, but have no evidence, this is my belief, that Americans and the Turks or the NATO allies were co-planning in order to create this rebalancing of the Middle East forces, making sure that Iran is not just defeated by Hezbollah, but not by Hamas only. Also, somehow, this golden bridge that was Syria had to be disrupted. Otherwise, Iran would spend more resources to rebuild Hezbollah, rebuild other forces of disruptions, and cause continuous destabilization, to say the least, but also maintain a claim that countries such as Jordan, such as Saudi Arabia, such as Bahrain and Kuwait, these are Western puppets, and therefore play that emotional and political game successfully. But by breaking the hold of Assad on Syria, suddenly the chain of access of resistance is decimated into pieces, and therefore the fact that Israel had battered Hezbollah, battered Hamas, Iran was focusing there, and Turkey was quietly building its resources and lining up. And everybody knew that Assad had no military. Assad had no real force on the ground. It was held from the aerial support by the Russians, ground support by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. And when those two forces were diverted elsewhere, Assad was left naked, and therefore the group that wanted to take over, and it's not one group, there are about 4 or 5 groupings, they had no resistance. City after city, day after day, they conquered, and the rest is history.
Are the people of Syria celebrating? And indeed, would the people of Iran be celebrating, given our previous conversation where you explained that in Iran it's a regime which has probably got 10% of support from its population?
Look, evidence from Germany, Sweden, Turkey, UK, in Syria, and the documents of celebration, jubilation, and importantly, people from Lebanon, more than a million of them, million of Syrians are now flowing back. People from Turkey flying back because they've been refugees. These are people who are very proud historically. They had a very rich and prosperous land or country, resourceful, not just from an economic point of view, from a cultural point of view. Suddenly they ended up in the ghettos of Beirut, in the ghettos of Istanbul, or in special homes for the refugees in Germany. That's not the proud people that Syrians are. So they are flocking back. Of course, they are flocking back, as many of them say, with a kind of mixed feeling. They are happy that they can go back to their motherland, but at the same time, they face an uncertain future. And that uncertainty is where, as we speak, may well go in different ways, depending how Turkey and the United States manage this transition. If they do it the way they did it in Iraq and Afghanistan, it will be another disaster. If they have learned lessons of how to create a kind of society that is not militarized, but draws on the internal resources of people's feelings, culture, and preferences, you could have a Syria that is, once again, just as it was before 1917, the 1950s, 1960s, and prior to that, a land of diversity and coexistence of different cultures, religions, alongside economic prosperity.
We haven't discussed the impact on Europe, but there are many who have been warning about the Islamic invasion of Europe, using the example of the Syrian refugees as being a spearhead of this. From what you've said, they've got it all wrong. And in fact, those people who landed in Europe against their will, really, will now be going back home. So I guess they can start being a little grateful, too, for what's happened.
Absolutely. That's why they're celebrating. I was listening to Al Jazeera and a whole lot of other online and sort of mainstream media. And I see that all Syrians, from small business owners to their intellectuals and philosophers and writers and ex-military people, they all have one common ambition, hope, and that is to go back. They don't want to stay in Germany. That doesn't mean that there aren't a couple of radicals, Al-Qaeda and this and that, terrorists who are in Belgium and in Germany and elsewhere. That goes without saying. But the majority of Syrians, the majority of Middle Easterns are not terrorists. They are hardworking, creative, and resilient people. And if Syria gets back to a kind of peaceful transition, which appears to be the case at the moment, I'm very mindful that in Iran also, when Khomeini came, it appeared very, very peaceful and talking democracy and independence and all of that. And within 9 months, it all went belly up and became what it is now. So I think one hopes that over the past 40 odd years in the Middle East, people have learned that unless a transition from authoritarian, brutal regimes of one kind or another becomes conducive to the celebration of diversity and peaceful coexistence, nobody can win and everybody will lose. Syria, as I mentioned, historically hasn't been religiously a demagogue or radical by any stretch of imagination. It has been a group of creative entrepreneurs, traders, philosophers, and really the hotbed of cultural development, music, etc., etc. If they can dig deep into that history, to that culture, they will be able to have a government of national unity in a true sense of the word. And Turkey seemed to at the moment play that song. Yesterday, I was listening to the foreign minister of Turkey, and he was very much very firmly saying we need to have a government of national unity. Turkey will not tolerate segmentation of the territorial integrity of Syria, etc., etc. These are all the good notes coming from Turkey, which no doubt in collaboration with the United States are underpinning these developments.
Which brings us to South Africa. It looks like we've backed the wrong horse here in a very big way. And I say we, perhaps we should be more specific and say the ANC.
Well, our foreign affairs and the ANC up until last year. So yes, they're cozying up to a regime in Iran that has this well-known ideology, strategic thrust, destabilization, and elimination of all people at all costs, and their way or highway. That kind of documented. These are not hypothesized or hypothesis or speculation. These are documented by the United Nations. To getting close to a regime that can happily wipe out 500,000 human beings in Syria, imprison its own nations, treat people, as I mentioned last time, women particularly. Remember that the mullahs in Iran have got two pillars on their ideology, elimination of Israel and subjugation of women. These two are non-negotiable for them. Now, these are the very two principles that's contrary to not only to our constitution, to any basic requirements of sustainability over time. Assad was powerful for 54 years, as you mentioned, but it collapsed. Iran may look, or Iranian regime may look very powerful, but when it becomes porous, when its values are no longer coherent and in sync with the people's support, where they lose 90 or 80% of citizens' support, when people are impoverished and so on, rest assured, Alec, it can collapse. It will collapse. Not because of my views, because basic principles of sustainability are not there. A government that is bankrupt, brutal, and pursues an ideology irrespective of its cost to its nation, irrespective of the cost to the region, etc., etc., and at the moment is quite marginalized in the Middle East. A year ago, they were dominant. 2 years ago, they were feared because of what they could do in every land that they wanted. Today, they are marginalized, defeated, not just ideologically, military, and otherwise, but defeated by economic forces. I cannot emphasize as an economist the importance of how terrible the conditions of Iranians, average Iranians, the majority of people are, despite the fact that they should be one of the most prosperous nations on the planet because of their resourcefulness. And yet, all those resources are used to destabilize the region, and the region has now taken a position they are not going to tolerate it, they're going to push back, and that's exactly what's happening. So, for us to protect the interests of South Africa, because there is a phenomenal capacity, really deep bilaterally beneficial trade and investment opportunities, but we cannot cozy up to a regime that is so disliked, hated, and opposed by the predominant majority of the nation.
What will happen to MTN in all of this? Do they not have the cell phone license in Syria as well, presumably given them by Iran and its ally? Assad, you would think that the MTN share price would come under some pressure as a consequence.
Yeah, and of course, Alec, to worsen the situation is given that Turkey is behind the force behind the new, if you like, dominant group that is likely to, at least in the short time, in the medium term, to be the dominant political control of Syria. Turkcell is the one that contests that MTN got the contract illegally and the paid bribes, etc., etc., and that case is still alive, and Turkey is going to get revenge when the dust settles, when the government is stabilized. At the moment, there are more urgent issues to deal with. They will focus on the transition. They'll stabilize the government, hopefully, and put some or other kind of ideology flag in the sand for the way forward. And when the government is under their control, they will start these type of questions around MTN, about Turkcell, and also about the use of networks, which has been used to eliminate many of the opponents of Assad. Bear in mind that Assad was the only dictator that used chemical weapons against his own nation. And as we speak, those factories are a major concern for Turkey, that it doesn't fall into the wrong hand. So yeah, that's the extent of sentiments. How they will deal with it is anybody's guess, but be watching that space.
But it's extraordinary that the ANC would have backed these regimes given its own history. And now it's going to reap the whirlwind or the consequence of this on the international front. But here in South Africa, do you think people really care about this? It's so far away.
I think as you started off by saying, Alec, we know so little. I'm repeating what you said. And we have so many issues of bread and butter emergency. Our municipalities are dysfunctional. Our general water, power, etc., etc. So the majority of South Africans, no, they don't. They have more urgent things to worry about, bread on the table tonight. And Iran is so far away, and this type of geopolitical dynamics are not on their radar. But one would hope that the business community, the Department of International Affairs, the government specifically, who is responsible for this type of analytics and decision-making, would at least learn from what has happened and re-evaluate the situation with one and only one goal in mind: to promote South Africa's interest guided by our constitutional democracy and constitutional principles. If we do that very well-defined path, we will come to a completely different conclusion.
Well, it's an opportunity and a threat, as one knows that those are two sides of one coin. But South Africa has really played this badly. And if you're an MTN shareholder, employee, executive, you've got to be doing some very, very deep reflective thinking after the developments of the last few days. Just to recap, Bashar al-Assad is in Moscow. So he's been given asylum by the Russians, who've propped up his regime. And as Iraj was explaining, the Russian foreign minister saying, "We were caught by surprise." So there's no question of who were keeping this autocrat in power. It's an interesting development. Geopolitics is now playing such a huge role, not just in South Africa, but all over the world. We need to pay attention. Our thanks to Dr. Iraj Avedian, the founder of Pan-African Capital, and I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.